You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the ancient city of Palmyra is in danger as ISIS advances. Syria has pleaded for help to save the UNESCO World Heritage Site, but how much will the international community be willing to do? My guests Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi are with me to give their views. Then Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi urges China to reconsider its approach to relations between the two Asian giants. But what are the real chances for improvement in the tangled relationship? Also on the programme, up to 8,000 refugees are currently stranded on the Andaman Sea as Thailand, Malaysia and Indonesia all refuse to let the ships dock. Meanwhile, European nations are also disagreeing over whether migrants arriving from North Africa should be allowed to live on the continent. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI here in London, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor at London's Evening Standard. Shashank and Robert, welcome to you both. As many as 8,000 refugees may be currently stranded in boats in the Andaman Sea off the coasts of Malaysia, Thailand and Indonesia. The decision by the three countries' governments to turn away crammed ships filled with Bangladeshis and ethnic Rohingya has caused international outrage. Human Rights Watch has warned of this deadly human ping pong, and the UN has described the policy to push back migrants trying to arrive as appalling. Meanwhile, here in Europe, European Commission's suggested migrant quota scheme is facing opposition from a number of countries, including the UK, Hungary, Slovakia, Finland and Estonia. Shashank, let's begin with what's happening in the Andaman Sea. And there's been some really heartbreaking footage of people on these boats in the last 24 hours. What can be done when the countries surrounding these boats all refuse to do what they're supposed to do?
Well, we're familiar in the European context with the question of should we rescue them, how much should we spend on mounting these round-the-clock patrols. The question in the Andamans is just awful, because you have a situation where Thailand in particular is actively towing boats out of its waters, where people have been adrift for 3 months in desperate need of medical assistance. They're chucking a bit of food on board, fixing the engine and saying, go on, good luck, make your own way out there, which is absolutely inhumane and completely against so many principles enshrined by various United Nations charters. I think the first thing we can do is apply more international pressure on these states. But I have to say, in order to credibly do that, it's going to be very hard for us to do it in Europe, given our own predicament with this.
And that's the thing, Robert Fox, isn't it? That, you know, the leaders of these countries, firstly, you know, let's take Thailand, not a democracy at the moment. But even those that are, will say to Europe, well, look, you've got this problem on your step and you're not letting people in. Why should we?
Yes, exactly. So, and also, as we just heard, the plight of these people who've been at sea for many, many days, if not weeks, is that they are a minority of a minority very often, and nobody really cares for them. We are looking at an acute crisis of the refugee in both cases. We'll obviously come on to the Mediterranean and Europe, which I think is acute there. But the idea that they have a place or a home to return to whence they came, in practical geopolitical terms, is absolute nonsense. You've got the Muslim minority refugees from Myanmar, and you have got Bangladeshi refugees, and there is nobody to speak for them. The difference, and I think, as we heard, the powerful difference is the glare of publicity is so much stronger in the Mediterranean. It is so much easier to get out there, and it's so much easier to cross-examine those who are purporting to roll out a policy, particularly the EU. It looks a pretty awful policy, and it looks a pretty threadbare one. But actually, in practical terms, there is nobody to speak for these refugees in the Andaman terms, in the Andaman Sea. The problem is, this is a crisis, a real crisis of our time.
And as Robert says there, Shashank, you know, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, there doesn't seem to be much pressure that can be put on those governments. And certainly at the moment, there doesn't seem to be much pressure inside those countries from civil society groups saying, no, we need to step up and do something here.
No, part of the problem is, you alluded to this, in Thailand, it's not a democracy. Try operating as a civil society group in Thailand today. I can tell you it's not that easy. I think the other issue here is they will care more about local voices, their trading partners, the bigger states in the region. Now, one of the issues is it's Indonesia, one of the biggest states in this part of the world, that is one of the problems here. But there are still other powers here which will be far more effective than any European state will be. And I'm talking here about Australia.
But what can Australia do? What right can Australia have to turn around to Indonesia and say, these people arriving in your country by boat, you should let them into your country?
They can only partly by the force of example, and that same, of course, applies to Europe. But I'm talking here about some of the more inhumane cases. Australia has great problems with its immigration policy and the way it treats these boats. In many cases, it's not quite as bad as what Thailand's doing. There is still a difference here, I think.
There we are, Australia, not quite as bad as Thailand when it comes to how it treats refugees. Robert Fox.
Pretty tough, this kind of stuff that Tony Abbott has been saying, and rather unwisely at the time of Gallipoli when he came over for the commemoration of that, did a lot of grandstanding and said, we have worked it out, this is the way to do it. The great misfortune of that is Mrs. Theresa May, who has been returned to be the Minister of the Interior, in other words, the Home Secretary in UK, thinks he can do that by tough love. It is a very self-defeating and very difficult approach. Mrs. May, and I'm coming on to now European migration, particularly in the Mediterranean, has suggested, and she is far from original in this, that certain people should be turned around and sent home, sent back to Libya, where they will be virtually stateless and in a very parlous condition in terms of law and order and security. What I wanted to add, does nobody remember Madame Edith Cresson, when she was Prime Minister of France, and she ordered the shackling of illegal Maghrebian refugees? They stopped it after three plane loads. The problem with the way the get tough policy falls apart, Tony Abbott, what you're hearing in the Andaman Sea, the tougher voices in Europe, is simply this. And I don't know where it comes from. They believe that if they arrest people, smugglers, or turn things round, or show we're getting tough, that will be a disincentive to the general flow of refugees into the great Mediterranean basin from a number of sources. I have been looking at this for nearly 40 years. I see no evidence whatsoever from interviewing refugees that this kind of thing has any effect whatsoever.
Shashank, is it perhaps less that they believe what they're saying when they say there will be a disincentive, or that they act tough towards the weak because, you know, unlike Thailand, we are democracies here in the European Union. And while, you know, we round this table might all think that what's being done here is heartless and inhumane, there'll be a number of people in these democracies who say, I don't want all these people coming to my country.
Well, it's very amusing today to watch Nigel Farage's party implode in highly complicated and slow motion fashion. But of course, we shouldn't forget for a second that they polled exceedingly well in this election, with no seats to show for it, but a very, very high vote share.
But let's not just talk about UKIP and its 4 million votes. It's, you know, the Conservative Party, Labour's been, you know, tough on migration as well.
A great deal of that, of course, stems from fear of having UKIP cut even further into their vote share. So I do think that lies at the heart of pulling Labour and the Tories in that direction.
True. But what I'm trying to get at is that there is not some groundswell of liberal opinion in Europe
which says
we should treat these people humanely.
If there was, Labour would have tacked in the other direction to sort of gain that block of liberal votes long ago. They completely failed to do so. We'll never know if it was really there at all, but certainly it's not enough to warrant that risk by any major party. And the same, of course, is true in France and other European countries.
Robert Fox, the European Commission, you called the plan threadbare, but we're saying at least there is a plan of sorts. But even this threadbare plan seems to be falling apart somewhat, because a number of countries are saying, okay, we understand your concerns about the pressures on Greece and the pressures on Italy, but we here in Estonia, Finland, Slovakia, Hungary, the UK, we don't want to take what you'd call our fair share.
I want to go back to something Shashank said. He was absolutely right to focus on UKIP, because the United Kingdom Independence Party, for all the farrago of policies it produced, was an anti-immigration party. It wasn't really even about Europe. So I agree with that. I agree with the proposition of your question. But it is fantastically short-sighted, because no great lover of pink Keynesian liberalism, but The Economist magazine has an amazingly interesting editorial on all this, this very week, this very day it came out, in the Charlemagne column. And it points to, here's an interesting thing, the demographic deficit of Europe. Actually, once you get over this, and it's a thing that even some of Mrs. Merkel's supporters in her party do realise, there's going to be such a deficit with the ageing of Europe, which is now becoming acute, there's going to be such a deficit of people of working age that, you know, the Gastarbeiter Turks made up a very, very important section of the labour force in Germany. It is going to be required. What we're looking at, and this is why we're being very parochial and very tactical, particularly as that's why I said it was a pretty threadbare policy from the EU, it is looking at the here and now. It's not looking at the bigger strategic picture. This is the readjustment of the human populace as we go to 9 or 10 billion. It is bound to happen. It's going to be pushed and pulled by all kinds of things. And one of the biggest catalysts is going to be climate change and the change of shapes of population, megalopoly and so on. Then this is why what disappoints me so much about the discussion only over the last week is that if it's, let's do it now, let's take a quota, let's have a very limited, this is under discussion as we speak this weekend, a very limited military intervention on the shores of Libya to stop the traffickers. That doesn't address the long-term phenomenon one whit. And it's a big thing. It will colour all the rest of my working and retiring life. I know there isn't much of that left, but it really is. It is absolutely the biggest, one of the biggest issues. And it is, as our sociologist and business studies friends like to say, it is truly a wicked problem, which means technically a problem with no obvious solution at the moment, as opposed to a knotty issue, which has a solution. But it's a wicked problem.
Shashank, you know, if we were to try and hope one day to solve that wicked problem that Robert alludes to, we have to then look not just at who's coming, but why they're coming and where they're coming from. And the countries that are being, where people are coming from are Eritrea, a brutal dictatorship, Syria, where there's a horrendous civil war,
a
brutal dictatorship, Somalia, where there hasn't been a functioning government in 3 decades. Yeah. These are big, long-term problems.
And I would add to that also much of the Sahel,
yes,
which is fueling the pool of many of the people coming through Libya. Libya is the most visible staging point of much of this, of course, but a lot of these people are coming from the Sahel, which for the, I think, climactic reasons in part that Robert pointed to and also the political reasons you did, is going to be a long, long-term problem.
We mentioned Syria, and let's move on now to Syria. The country is calling for help from the international community to stop ISIS advancing on the ancient city of Palmyra, considered to be one of the region's most important historic sites. Syria's antiquities chief warns that if ISIS seizes the UNESCO World Heritage Site, it will destroy everything there. Robert Fox, we are somewhere between a rock and a hard place here, aren't we?
And a very, very beautiful city in the most extraordinary stone. It is one of the real highlights of, it's a mishmash. There's a temple of Baal there, as you get in Baalbek. A lot of it is late Roman. The great thing about Palmyra, by the way, is dates. It is the great entrepot. It is one of the great crossroads of the desert. And in terms of monuments, it matches. It's not quite as extended, but it complements, not quite the same period again, Petra Deserti in Jordan. It really is staggering. It's going to be a test. I think the world community will do absolutely nothing if ISIS gets in there. I'm very, very sad. We've seen what happened to Nineveh. That, yes, we bleat a lot about it, but we don't go to war over monuments. What is far more worrying, I'd be very interested to hear what Shashank's got to say, it looks to me as if we are actually seeing the last months, if not the last days, beginning to see the last months of Bashar al-Assad's military regime.
Well, we'll perhaps come on to that in a moment, and I'm fairly sure you're not the first person to say that, that we're seeing the last months of that over the past three or four years.
They're not doing very well at the moment.
I'm happy to come back onto that in a moment. But Shashank, on this issue of Syria asking for help from the international community, as Robert suggests, there's absolutely no way this is going to happen. Not just because it's it's rocks, not people, but because there's absolutely no way that the West can come in to support Bashar al-Assad.
Not in the slightest. More than that, certainly not this week, when President Obama's been meeting his Arab allies at Camp David in Maryland in the United States and promising them, what can I do against Iran to help roll back Iran's influence? And by extension, what can I do to weaken the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which now not only Saudi Arabia, but also its ostensible rivals, Turkey and Qatar, are now together coordinating policies against. At this particular moment, those allies are irritated, putting it mildly, that Obama's policy is to fundamentally ignore Syria beyond a few highlights, Kobani last year, of course, and focus entirely on Iraq. So there's that side of it. And of course, on the same week, even today, I should say, or yesterday, the city of Ramadi has fallen, the capital of Anbar province in next door Iraq. This is far, far more important to the United States in terms of the impact it will have on their Iraq first policy than Palmyra will be. So for those reasons, it's inconceivable the US will intervene. And I think some of them will say it's not ideal, but if it applies more pressure on Assad and forces Iran perhaps to negotiate with us more seriously about a peace deal, all the better for that.
And I want to ask you about Robert's question on, are we seeing the last days, weeks, months?
I think Robert's right on the trend. They've lost Jisr al-Shughur, they've lost Idlib. There's been enormous infighting at the top, several of the top intelligence chiefs gone, some of them killed. This is serious. This is the weakest he's been for 2 years. Having said that, and I speak as someone who's got this wrong before and prematurely fired off on this, I think it's probably more than months. I think it could be still more than a year. But I think this is a sort of inflection point, nevertheless.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. In a moment, we'll be talking about Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ongoing trip to China. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It was designed by a suspect bohemian, houses a coup plotter, and today is favoured by young liberal creatives. Madrid's Edificio Princesa is a concrete testament to the contradictions of Spain's transition to democracy, as our correspondent Liam Aldis discovered.
Today, the building that was once dubbed the bunker by Madrileños is now seen in a very different light, as plant life has progressively engulfed the structure, fulfilling the architect's original vision and providing residents with plenty of verdant balconies. Edificio Princesa is being celebrated as a model of inner city, high density architecture that has withstood the test of time.
On the home front, a photographic portrait now playing in the film section at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, my guests, Shashank Joshi and Robert Fox. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has today continued his state visit to China, and he's urged the country to reconsider its approach to issues that have long strained the relationship between the two Asian giants. After China, Modi is heading to Mongolia. This visit is significant in historical terms, as no Indian Prime Minister has visited Ulaanbaatar before. I'm sure he'll be coming home with a souvenir or two. Shashank, if we stick first of all with India and China, the fact that that Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi have met and appear to be getting on, and I see Modi with the Chinese Prime Minister today seem again to be sort of enjoying themselves together, sharing. They seem to have a better relationship than Chinese leaders have had with other regional leaders. Are you hopeful that actually these two countries can come to more of an understanding about their relationship?
I am. I think the Chinese respect strength, and they respect a strong leader like Modi, who is, on the one hand, building up his relationship with the United States and willing to show that he's signing off on pretty unprecedented statements about the South China Sea, which you would have thought would enrage the Chinese, and of course endorsing the US pivot. And on the other hand, keeping the agenda economics focused. When he talks directly to the Chinese, he recognizes, look, India needs $1 trillion of investment over the next 10 years. The only country in the world with lots of capital in the control of the state is Beijing. And Modi wants it. He wants it for his roads, for his power plants, for his factories. And I think that they are also have, you know, keeping one eye on issues of common interest, like Afghanistan, where they know their, you know, US and others are leaving. They both have important mineral and other interests. It's a wary relationship. You know, the border flared up when Xi Jinping visited Delhi last year. They'll be talking the border dispute just now. And as I said, Xi Jinping knows Modi is flirting with Obama furiously. But I think so far they've kept it on a very mature and effective track.
Robert Fox, it seems like a more pragmatic relationship than other countries feel that they can have with China, particularly Western nations that think, well, we must always mention human rights, or if we don't mention human rights, we're going to get in trouble back home. Obviously, Narendra Modi isn't going to have those problems, despite the fact India is obviously a huge democracy. It's got less issues in that sense. Do you think that makes it slightly easier for India and China to have this sort of relationship?
I think it's very important, and I think, as you alluded, there's a tremendous amount of realism about this. It's the mood music, as you rightly say. This is what's going on. I think there aren't going to be staggering announcements. But these two giants realise where they're positioned. You know, with across the Indian Ocean into the South China Sea, over 50, 60% of the world's commerce within 20 or 30 years is going to be done in that sea space. They know that, and they know they've got to work together, because there are bits and pieces that they really don't like and where they do have a common interest. I doubt if they'll have been talking about it, but I think their diplomats and experts will. What on earth is going to happen to North Korea? What happens for China? The nightmare there is if North Korea just suddenly, and it's always possible, it's a bit like our discussion about Assad, could implode. And that would be very worrying indeed. They're both aware, because they've both flirted with them, and one is an enemy, is the instability of Pakistan is extremely worrying to both of them, which feeds into or feeds out of Afghanistan. And then, of course, Kashmir is always the symptom there. It is looking very, very volatile again at the moment. The Chinese regime, and I'm not a sinologist, is conservative, quite military, and therefore quite practical, as you say. It does plans, tactics, schemes of manoeuvre, and quite a steady state strategic vision, in that these two are the 1 billion plus powers and they've got to make it work together. And I think what you are seeing, and you rightly said in your question, a working relationship.
I just want to say that pragmatism you talked about and these nationalist pressures, they don't always, it's not, leaders may have these sort of careful reflective approaches to their relationship. Below the surface, it's very messy, though. This week, Modi faced enormous criticism when the Chinese media showed a map of India without Kashmir and without Arunachal Pradesh, which is claimed by China as South Tibet, 90,000 square kilometres. The Indian media was apoplectic and wanted, you know, India to sort of throw the table over and go home. Modi is able to deal with this in part because he is a strong right-wing leader. A Congress-led government with a feeble prime minister like Manmohan Singh would have struggled and would have had to make a noise. Modi doesn't have to.
He's India's Nixon.
Well, he's India's Nixon, he's India's Abe, he's India's Xi Jinping. There's a constellation of nationalist leaders who, one hopes, are able to resist their own nationalist simmerings precisely because of their credentials.
Let's move on. Russia is expected to introduce new powers to prosecute foreigners whose activities are seen as undesirable on national security grounds. Russian MPs are due to vote on a bill to ban certain foreign non-governmental organisations or firms. What exactly constitutes undesirable is open for discussion, as the draft law doesn't offer a definition. Robert Fox, this is sort of one extra little step in a certain direction for Russia, isn't it?
This sort of thing's been around. Do you remember they had they closed down the offices of the British Council, claiming that it was a subversive cultural organisation? Yes, I do think. I think it's bad news for the Greenpeaces of this world, you know, Friends of the Earth, because they can always throw in the nationalist card. You are operating, if they uncover inconvenient facts, you're operating against the stability and reputation of our country. And you have to take into consideration how heavily, I don't say solidly, but heavily pro-Putin, the lower house of the Duma is. And this is a symptom of that. I think there will be quite a lot of nonsense. I think quite a few Russian intelligentsia, if I'm allowed to use such a vulgar and old-fashioned expression, will be absolutely against it. I think Yes, it's a slightly puff of the cheeks reaction to it, but not surprising, given the way that in these discussions in this program, we've tracked the way Putin and Putin's view of the great Russian nation in the European house, as he calls it, is going.
And Shashank, it's not just Russia that is introducing these sorts of laws. We've seen it in Ethiopia and other parts of Africa.
I've seen it in India as well. Mm. I just saw only a few months ago the India used its domestic intelligence agency to apply pressure on the Ford Foundation, which, you know, they say was a front for US intelligence. They stopped a Greenpeace activist from speaking to members of the House of Commons. This isn't just about Putin authoritarianism. This is about strong states trying to control civil society and keep it within bounds. And I think it's very, very disturbing indeed.
Here's a question, Robert. How do you think Britain would feel about NGOs operating in this country that got a lot of money from the Chinese or the Russian governments?
I think they'd feel very, very sensitive, and particularly, again, to use the Shashank formula, we've got a right-wing government. I mean, it's not extremely right-wing, but it is well right of centre, which we didn't have with the coalition. I can't believe somebody like Mrs. May, who I've invoked before, would love it at all. I'm afraid it's something you really do have to live with, because as you've been hinting, what these people, it is slightly Canute-like, what we're seeing in India and above all Russia, which is what your question about, is they're trying to push back the NGO-led conversation in the social media sphere, where they are immensely powerful, where they are very effective with their lobbying. And unless they go for an all-out attack on closing down aspects of the internet, say the Googles and whatever, they don't stand a chance of really getting away with this.
Well, I should say we do restrict what channels like Press TV can say.
Absolutely, sorry,
Al-Manar, Hezbollah's channel, Russia Today has run into difficulties with Ofcom, but that's broadcasting. We don't do it with NGOs. And historically, and I'm talking the last 50, 60 years, of course, we did have these issues with CND, potential Soviet funding. We've had it recently with Russian donations to even mainstream parties like UKIP. If we think China and Russia are not plowing cash into the UK for state-led subversive purposes, I think we're naive. Now, whether the Ford Foundation or the National Democratic Institute, which I used to work for in Moscow, by the way, before it was beaten into submission, I don't think they're quite the same instruments of state-led deviousness as Press TV is. But I do think we are a more open, tolerant society. We must stay that way. Unfortunately, Theresa May has come up with these mad ideas on defining extremism so broadly, it could sweep up exactly these kind of issues into the Home Secretary's net.
Agreed. Terrible mistake what they're doing in the UK, they're proposing at the moment in dealing with extremism, as Shashank was saying. It will just create reaction and will not be effective. It's also, may I say, it's rather ancient Brit now, it's very un-British, curiously.
We're going to finish today with new research suggesting that humans' attention span has decreased drastically since the turn of the millennium. In 2000, the average human attention span was estimated to be 12 seconds. Now, apparently, it's 8 seconds. Ironically enough, we only have about 25 seconds left to discuss this. Shashank, are you surprised by this?
Not at all. As someone who scans Twitter compulsively and has struggles to read anything more than a page long, I'm intimately acquainted with this phenomenon.
Robert Fox, 8 seconds.
What was the question? I've forgotten it already.
A good moment to end. Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Claire Lancaster. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Josh Fennett is here next, and then it's the Menu with Marcus, that is at 1900 hours. Midori House is back at the same time on Monday afternoon, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.